a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
And man, Dr. Carl, what a week it's been.
Well, science is a wonderful thing, and wonderful things have been
happening. And this week has proved it.
Yeah, planets, people jumping out of space and not dying. Mind you, they did half a century ago, but I reckon it's an amazingly brave thing because it's, firstly, it was something that was done in an inherently hostile environment.
We're talking about the space jump by Felix Baumgartner.
Yeah, jumping from 39 kilometres up where if there had been a hole in his spacesuit, he would have died, or if there'd been a minor technological problem like his sun, his visor fogging up, all sorts of stuff. There were so many things that could have killed him.
But that did happen. His visor did fog up and he had to make the choice on whether or not to jump.
Yes, and he did. And apparently they went offline for a little while where he talked with Joe Kittenjap, who was a guy who did it half a century ago from 31 kilometres rather than 39. And it was interesting, they followed the method used in the space program where the only person who spoke to the astronauts was a fellow astronaut.
Yeah.
There are all these techos, all these scientists, all these engineers, but the person who actually turned into English was a fellow astronaut. So it was really good to have a fellow jumper, if you like, talk.
If you haven't seen the footage of the point where Felix is at the edge of his little pod and he has to jump into a very big space of nothingness, watch it. It's incredible. If you've ever skydived, you know that feeling, but this is like skydiving times 3,000. So check it out if you haven't already. One of the questions that I wanted to know, and I'm sure I'm not alone, is what happens physically to the body when you break the sound barrier? Would have he felt anything as he was falling down?
There are overpressures and underpressures on an aeroplane whenever it's travelling faster than the speed of sound because the molecules can't get out of the way. So it's not just at the moment of pushing through the sound barrier, but at all times that you are travelling faster than the speed of sound, you are creating overpressures and underpressures which lead to the sonic boom. Mm. In his case, if he were to be able to breathe and be wearing a skin-tight, flexible suit, I reckon he would have felt the pressure waves rippling upon his skin.
Wow.
But he was wearing comfort padding right against his body, then pressure insulating material on top of that, then a netting material on top of that, and then finally something that was both strong and fireproof. So I reckon it was stiff enough to have insulated him from feeling the pressure waves.
Incredible.
Brave guy. And to one thing I don't understand is that he fell from a greater height and yet he made it more quickly to the ground. His time of free fall was less.
Well, he was going faster, wasn't he?
Maybe the being going faster more than compensated for the greater distance he had to cover. That's one confusion I've got.
Well, that's one of the big things that happened in science. Also, a planet was discovered. We'll talk about that in a little while. I want to jump into TalkBack, though, because I know you've got lots of questions as well. 1-300-055-36 if you want to chat with Dr. Carl, ask him a science question. That's what we're doing till midday today. And we're going to go from space jumps to farts. That's where we're beginning today. Hello, Josh in Adelaide.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Zan and Dr. Carl.
Dr. Josh, welcome to the show.
Yeah, sorry to bring it down to this level so early in the program.
Please, we love fun talk.
I've been thinking, say I'm in a car or a truck with a person that is sick and they've got the average cold or chicken pox or something like that, and then they fart and I breathe in their fart. Do I have the chance to get their sickness, their exact sickness, or something like that?
This actually was asked on this very radio station about 12 years ago when an operating theatre nurse said, I've been working in the theatres all day, in and out of sterile gear, and there was a really short break, and by the time I got unsteriled, I'd have to get steriled up again. So I just sat in the theatre, the empty theatre, and waited for things to happen. And it was an empty theatre, and I had a desire to pass wind, to have a fart. So I did. And then immediately afterwards I thought, wow, have I de-steriled the theatre? So I went looking through the literature and I found that the answer is maybe. Now, you know when there's a whole team of people involved in going to hospital in the surgery, and there's always, if you're going unconscious, the anaesthetist whose main job used to be to listen to the beep, beep, beep machine and also do the crossword in the local newspaper every day. And in between cases, when they're not doing stuff in keeping the patient alive, the anaesthetist or the anaesthesiologist, as the Americans foppishly call it, would run around the hospital and go and see different people in different parts of the hospital to assess their fitness for surgery the next day.
Mm.
And there was one case in the medical literature of a guy who didn't wear underpants, did wear only the single layer of hospital greens. Now, remember the nurse? Now, the theatre nurse would have had underwear and then her normal blue clothing and then theatre gear and then the sterile gear on top of that. So she would have had three or four layers.
Mm.
So the fart would have been filtered. And by the way, a guy called Luke Tennant had listened to the show and did some experiments where he got somebody in his family, he was a microbiologist, to actually fart at close range upon some culture plates and found that there was a double zone. There was the initial blast zone, or the IBZ as he called it, and then there was the SR, or the splatter ring around it, and he found different bacteria. And in one, he found bum bacteria, and in the other, he found skin bacteria. Getting back to our anesthesiologist.
Very visceral conversation we're having.
He seemed to leave a trail of infection behind in many of the patients he went to, and he was a bit notorious for farting.
I was going to say, dropping bombs all through the hospital.
Yeah. But he was wearing only a single layer of clothing. Now, in general, you're not going to get any problems from getting a bit of fecal bacteria on you because you've got lots of bacteria. But if you're dealing with a case, I mean, you don't go to hospital because you're well.
Mm.
You go there because you're sick and their immune systems could have been down and they thought that there was some case, and so the resolution was that he had to wear underpants.
So
an extra layer.
If you just, if someone's got a cold, not in this situation where you need to be super, super safe and what's the word I'm looking for?
Clean, sterile.
But if someone's in a car and they're farting and they're sick, can you get sick from those farts?
Almost certainly not. All of the fecal bacteria will be trapped by their clothing.
Well, Josh,
okay.
You got
don't wear their clothes.
You got a hell of an answer.
Unless, of course, they're travelling nude with you and then lifting themselves off the seat. I hadn't considered that possibility.
Let's not go down that road because I know you'll probably have a story for it. Hey, thanks for the call,
thank
Josh.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for getting off to a good
start.
Good
on you, mate. Let's go to Clayton and see if Jesse can follow that. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jesse,
what's your
welcome.
Question?
Hello, Docs Carl and Dr. Van. My question is, do you know where heart consciousness comes from and have you heard of it before?
Are you referring to the case when somebody had a heart transplant and the person that
they started
the
remembering
from,
things that they never, you know what I mean?
And they started loving the food that that person had loved.
Exactly right.
I never read the original article, but I only heard about it secondhand. I didn't read the original peer-reviewed medical article. And then secondhand, I also heard in the literature that it was had been disproved. Now, if somebody listening could put up on Dr. Carl Twitter, D-O-C-T-O-R-K-A-R, or Twitter, if they could spend 15 minutes searching through Google Scholar and just check if that was real or not.
There's also like something goes with it because basically our heart emits an EM field, sort
what
of like electromagnetic field,
yep.
About 5 feet from our body.
Yep.
So, and our planet does the same thing from within its core, and that's what protects us from our like all the cosmic radiation and stuff like that.
Oh, no, the first two things are correct. The last one is not. What protects us from cosmic radiation is the combination of the magnetic field around the Earth and the Earth's thick atmosphere. There are lots of claims. Look, every part of your body gives off an electromagnetic field. Don't believe the health claims involving electromagnetic fields, especially if they use the word quantum. They're lying to you. I'm sorry.
Hey, thanks for the call, Jesse.
Thank you. And we'll try and get an answer for you from the peer-reviewed literature.
Cheers, mate. We're going to come back with some more, including the news about this new planet that has several suns around it orbiting or it orbiting. Dr. Carl's going to explain what happened in the last day or so in science. It's been a big week. Triple J, some classic Kanye for Felix, who jumped from 39 kilometres above the Earth this week and landed safely. I wonder if he was singing Feels Good to Be Home as he landed and ran.
Mate, it wasn't scary when he started tumbling because the real worry is the flat spin.
Yeah.
So imagine you get a playing card and you lay it flat on the table and you get a pin and you just sort of poke the pin into the playing card and then you flick it with your fingernail and go spin, spin, spin. Joe Kittinger went through a flat spin at 120 spins per minute. That's 2 a second, like blub, blub, right? And the blood goes to your head and you can, besides having problems with your eyeballs, you can go unconscious, you can have a stroke, and he managed to get out of it. And you don't have a lot of of what they call aerodynamic authority. And it was really scary when he went into that tumble.
But he got
came
out
of it. So I was wondering, would he have done training with gymnastic people to learn the right waist? There's a whole book in that. Whoa, that's a good idea. Never heard of that one.
There you go. Dr. Carl's next book about Felix. Also, the other thing that happened that I mentioned earlier this hour was that there was a new planet discovered in the last 36 hours. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a bunch. I know there's a bunch. Well, there's two.
So casual.
There's in our galaxy, there's around 400,000 million stars. And the one that's closest to us of all is called Alpha Centauri. When I say it, there's actually two stars going around each other, Alpha Centauri A and B, and then there's a third one which might be going around them. And right next to Alpha Centauri B is a planet that's almost the same size as the Earth, except it's a lot closer. Mm. It's 6 million kilometres away, not 150 million kilometres away, so it's really, really hot. It goes around in about 3 days instead of 365 years. So it's definitely not what they call the Goldilocks zone. The Goldilocks zone is when everything's perfect, you know, like Goldilocks, the beds is just the right softness, right? The Goldilocks zone is when you have water, not as a solid, not as a steam, but liquid. This is way in the steam zone. But the way they found it was amazing. So, okay, the planet's the right size. It's too hot for life as we know. It might have another form of life on it. But the way they found it was they used the unbalanced bicycle wheel method. So imagine you've got a bicycle wheel and it just spins and it's perfectly spinning beautifully. Then you put a little lead weight on one end of it and as it spins, it sort of goes this way and that way and this way and that way. And so you think about a star and it's got a planet going around it. Well, the planet pulls it this way and that.
Yeah.
And the distance, and so it wobbles a little bit. And this was the measurement was the most sensitive they've ever made. The speed at which it wobbled towards us and away from us was the speed of a crawling baby. 1.8 kilometres per hour.
Oh, wow.
And they were able to measure that. So that was one planet they found that's the size of the Earth, but it's in a messy zone, too hot. The other planet was associated with not one star or two stars, not three, but four.
Yeah.
So there were two stars going around each other and there was a planet going around that star and then there were another two planets, another two stars going around that first set of stars. So there were four stars going around this planet and it was about six times bigger than the Earth, but unfortunately, once again, too hot. But we're going to find something out there.
Yeah.
Like when my father was born, there was no such thing as flying airplanes. Before he died, people had gone to the moon and back. In the generation of people born today, there will be similar changes.
It's going to be big. Just keep watching. Keep looking to the sky, guys. 1-300-055-36 if you've got a question. Let's get back into them and head to the Gold Coast now where Matthew has been waiting. Hey, Matthew.
Hey.
Hey, what's your question?
I've got a question about my job and if it has mentally conditioned me. I work with point-of-sale systems and mostly restaurants. About 12 hours of the week, I spend it looking at menus or making changes to menus, so food and wine. And if this is over time, I worked for the company for 3 years, has it changed my taste in food and drink and possibly consumption as well?
Yes. Basically, you're the product of your DNA, your genes, and what age you are, because as you age, your tastes change. And so kids in general, newborn kids, the younger you are, the more you hate bitter stuff. And the older you are, the more you like it. And bitter stuff tends to have anti-cancer chemicals in it. And then finally, there's the environment in which you spin. And so we were having lunch with somebody the other day who didn't do Lebanese food because, and I quote, she didn't do dips.
Now,
I'm not too sure what's so offensive about getting a lump of bread and putting it in something softish and sticking it in your face, but they changed. By the end of the meal, she was eating it. So you are changing as a result of where you live. You are not a fixed, constant thing. You are subject to people around you. And even now, Zan and I have changed you by this conversation.
We're moulding you, Matthew. Okay. Thanks for the call, mate.
Cool. Thank you.
Let's head to Toowoomba where Sarah's on the line. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
I just wanted to ask Dr. Carl about dreaming. When you have really vivid dreams, like, for example, last night I was at the movies, watching a movie. It was absolutely hilarious. I actually woke up laughing. The cinematography was brilliant. Yet when I woke up, I have no recollection of ever seeing a movie like that before. Another example is being female. I've had so many dreams where I've walked into these incredible walk-in wardrobes just full of amazing clothes and shoes. Once again, I've woken up and thought, where did I get that from? So am I actually tapping into the part of my brain that I'm not using during the day, or when I'm dreaming, am I relying on memories that I've stored away?
The tapping into parts of your brain that you haven't used before and that you normally cannot access. So there are two Sarahs. There's a Sarah that lives in the daytime, and when you're asleep, you're not zombied out. And the only way you can get into a house is if they invite you in. You're not zombied out. You're not a different form of consciousness. You are a different form of consciousness. That's a different person. And that person has different creative abilities. And normally the wake Sarah never meets the sleeping Sarah. And it's so frustrating because you have all these wonderful ideas about the movie. All you had to do was just remember 5 minutes of that movie and then take it to Hollywood as a script and you could be a big-time Hollywood producer. Or the clothes that you see in a wardrobe. You could be there in Vogue magazine.
I could be a fashion designer. So
you could. Now, I've tried it myself, and I, at one stage in my past, I discovered the secret to the universe, and I kept on forgetting it, and it came to me night after night. So I went to bed with a notepad, and I said to myself, I'm going to write down. In the morning, the notepad was covered with me where I had written down, write it down. So I missed out. I was that close to getting the secret of the universe. But scientists, for example, Kekule, K-E-K-U-L-E, discovered the chemical formula for benzene in his sleep. So if you can tap into that, and it's really hard, mate, you could be a fantastic clothes designer, movie producer and scriptwriter all in one.
So can you bridge the gap?
That's the hard bit. I end up with write it down 15 million times, mate. Right. I never got any closer.
Hey, thanks for the call, Sarah.
But you might be able to do it. Give it a go, Sarah.
Let's head to Adelaide where Max is on the phone. Hey, Max.
Hi, Max.
Hey.
Hello.
How you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Just curious. We've got a lemon tree, and it's my housemate's lemon tree. And when he brought it over, he specifically asked us to piss upon it. And we've been doing that, and all of a sudden the leaves have started to drop off, and it's looking quite ill, so we ceased urinating on it. And I was just wondering if there comes a point where you will urinate on a tree too much.
Yes. There's an old motto in medicine, just because a little is good, comma, it doesn't mean that more is better. A little bit of food is good, but 15 mils a day is not better. So you could be overloading it with nutrients. 20% oxygen, 21% is what we've evolved for. 100% oxygen is actually toxic. A little bit of water is good, but people have killed themselves by hyponatremia, by drinking too much water and getting brain swelling.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's not as simple as a little bit is good, therefore more must be better. No.
As with all things in life, it's all about balance, isn't it, Craig?
Oh, man. I shall follow you, master.
Maybe use the toilet a few times, Max.
That's what we're going to do.
Good on you, mate. Thanks for the call. Tim's in Riverina today and is calling us up. Good morning, Tim.
Doctors, how are you?
Very well. What's your question?
I've got a question. I'm a freediver. I'm sort of getting into it, really. I can hold my breath for probably a minute and a half, 2 minutes, if I'm lucky. I just want to know what sort of drastic changes your body needs to go through for these people that can hold their breath, 5 or 6 minutes?
Look up a thing called the diving reflex, like how you dive off a board?
Yeah.
The diving reflex. So many marine animals like seals and sea lions have this, and we humans have it to a lesser degree, but some humans have got a lot of it and some people have got less of it.
Okay.
And we did this as a first-year physiology experiment. So you just put a snorkel on your face and then you stick your face in water.
Yeah.
And by itself, due to a reflex previously wired up by the manufacturer for your benefit in your brain, the diving reflex kicks in. Your heart rate slows down by itself.
Yeah.
Your metabolic rate slows down. Your breathing rate slows down. You don't have to do this deliberately. You consume less oxygen. And in a full-on diving reflex, the blood supply is diverted away from where it's temporarily not needed. Your gut can go without your blood. Your gut and your muscles can go without blood, but you got to keep it going to your brain. And so that's what they try to do. And I think it's crazy. Some of these guys go down for, what, 5 minutes? Like, I was talking to a big surfer guy who was in waves, and the trouble, he does a really big waves. I've forgotten his name. Carol, that's right. Matt, there's a couple of Carols. Matt Carroll, one of those guys? No, never heard of him.
You're the surfer.
I'm not a surfer. I'm not a surfer's pimple. But anyway, I was talking to him about it. And you see, what happens is you just barely float in water. Just barely, you know, around nose level. If the water is full of bubbles, mate, you don't float, you sink. And so if you're a surfer person and you get tumbled by a big wave, well, you just sink to the bottom and you just sit there and you push yourself off and you fall down again. And Mr. Carroll can hold his breath for 5 minutes and he's trained himself up to it. Plus, he's told me they also now have an extra emergency exit. They have a tight-fitting vest with a carbon dioxide cylinder, and when they pull on it, it dumps the carbon dioxide, inflates, gets them to the surface real quick. In your case, maybe something, I mean, I think it's a scary service, but I'm Maroubra, and we had a barbecue once, and this guy turned up, some Brazilian guy, and he said, you need fish. Okay. And then he came back about an hour later with a fish. And what he'd done was swim out into the lanes, the shipping lanes about half a kilometre out to sea, with a spear gun, sat on the bottom for 3 minutes, waited for a fish to go past, shot it, and then swam back to shore, and he brought back this bloody half-meter-long fish.
Whoa.
Who is this crazy person?
Someone who can hold their breath.
Yes.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Tim.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone texting in. Tom Carroll is the surfer that you're thinking of.
And he's a god.
Let's head to Newcastle where Bill is on the line. Hey, Bill.
G'day.
Hello, what's your question?
Good morning, Dr. Carl. Good morning, Dr. Zan. I actually conducted an experiment without even meaning to, which was clever for me, I reckon. But I put hot soup in my mouth, made a lovely big batch of homemade pumpkin soup, and I found that it burnt the tissue on the roof of my mouth, the side of my mouth, the bottom of my mouth, and I got blisters. But I never got a blister on my tongue. And I'm wondering why.
Ah, you can get blisters on your tongue.
Yep.
And I think it's because the tongue has a very rich blood supply. So it was just hot enough to create blisters, but not on your poorly vascularized mucous membrane of the hard part of your mouth, but on the tongue, which has a tremendous blood supply. The heat was immediately taken away into the core. If you'd had even hotter soup, you could have had blisters on the tongue. I've had blisters on the tongue.
Okay, so it actually works the same as if you'd stuck your tongue straight in cold water, but not the rest of your mouth.
Sort of, by
taking away the heat.
Yes, it's taking away the heat by its very rich blood supply.
Okay.
But I've had this weird thing where after I go swimming in the ocean, it's warming up now, a piece of chocolate, which normally melts in 5 seconds, sits on my tongue for 20 minutes like a bit of candle wax.
Really?
Wow.
20 minutes.
So you've got a poor blood supply.
Well, I thought that the tongue was part of the central core blood supply, but maybe it can be split off. But I walk in the door, I put the chocolate on my tongue because my daughter, I was coming back from swimming in the pool and my daughter gave me a coffee, and of course with coffee you've got to have chocolate.
Yep.
It's God's law. And so I put the chocolate on my tongue and I went in the shower and I put the coffee on the side, ready to have it as soon as the chocolate melted. Mate, I stretched that shower out to 15 minutes, the bloody thing wouldn't melt. Like candle wax, it just sat on my tongue.
Excellent.
So I reckon it's the situation. You just haven't done it hot enough and don't do it too hot.
Fair enough. No, I don't think it's an experiment I want to conduct.
No,
thanks for the call, Bill.
Thank you, Dr. Bill.
Good on you, mate. Let's head to Brisbane where Scott's on the line. Hi, Scott.
Morning, doctors. How are we?
Very well.
Good, Scott.
What's your question, Scott?
Well, I was in the bathroom the other day pondering life's many questions when I noticed that my grey hairs in my beard, I've just got a bit of salt and pepper bearded on my head as well. Why do the grey hairs grow longer and sometimes straighter?
Yes. This is very exciting. I can't remember whether it was the Journal of Dermatology or something, but it seems like what we thought about grey hairs is all wrong. So what happens is, I'll give you the order in which it happens, right? So you've got all these hair follicles, 100,000 on your skull, and maybe, I don't know, 5,000-10,000 on your beard zone. Do you get a big, bushy Abraham Lincoln beard?
No.
How do you do your beard? My son's been trying all different beard styles, by the way. Just wondering what you go for.
I just go for the, I just let it grow out, and then I just trim it back, either with just a clippers with no sort of comb on them, or I just tuck them back to like a number two comb.
You haven't tried an Abraham Lincoln or the centre face clear? Okay, moving right along. So what happens is that each hair is made by a hair follicle, one to one, and each follicle has a sub-factory in it that makes dye. So you're putting in a red dye, a blackish dye, a brownish dye, whatever it is.
Yeah.
This is how the pathology goes. For some unknown reason, and we do not know why, the hair follicle starts producing more hair. The hair is both thicker, so therefore the hair follicle has to work harder, and it's being produced at more millimetres per week. Instead of 1 millimetre per week, you're getting 2 millimetres per week.
Yeah.
So the hair follicle is working overtime. As a result, the metabolites from its manufacture, you know, it's got a little factory there, don't get taken away. The bad guys are called ROS, or reactive oxidative species. So firstly, your hair follicle goes into overdrive, then the ROSs, the reactive oxidative species, they attack the dye factory.
Right.
And so then it can't make any more dye. So what you've done is you've manufactured for a week, a month, a year, these extra long single hairs that are thicker and coming out longer, and then they suddenly get no dye.
Yeah.
And you've killed the dye part, the dye factory in the hair follicle. So that's why grey hairs are longer and thicker, because that's how they get made in the first part. It's part of the pathology of killing the dye part of the hair factory.
Right.
Hey, thanks for the call, Scott.
Thank you.
Good on you, mate. Let's head to Canberra where Josh is on the phone. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, guys.
Hello. What's your question?
I was wondering, if you were looking through a telescope at a planet that was, say, 10 million light years away, and you saw somebody looking back at you in a telescope, would they see Earth of what it was 10 million light years ago, or would they see it in current time?
Nothing happens in current time. So when you look at me across a football field 300 metres across, you're seeing me 1 millionth of a second ago.
Mm.
So light travels at roughly 300 metres, a football field, in a microsecond. And so the sun, you saw it was there 8 minutes ago. Nothing happens in real time. Then, as the hippie said, you know, reality's for people who can't handle drugs, mate. Nothing's real.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good on you, Josh. Let's head to Edinburgh in South Australia. Good morning, Luke.
Luke, love
your
work.
Hey, you've got a great question that I want to know the answer to. What is it?
Yeah, Dr. Carl, I was wondering what your theory is on when you get older, you feel like the months and years go by a lot quicker as compared to when you're a kid.
Yep. I remember when I was a kid, they were going to do a road diversion or expressway somewhere near where I was living. And I was told about it towards the end of 1 year, and it was going to happen in April of next year. I couldn't conceive of such a long time. We had to go all the way from where I was up to Christmas, and then past Christmas and back to school, and then into April. I couldn't believe it. And so that 6 months was probably 10% of my life, or, you know, 15% of my whole life. But as you get older, each span of time gets a shorter percentage of your whole life. You know, 1 year out of 30 is, you know, bigger, is smaller than 1 year out of 10.
Oh, okay.
So each unit of time you experience is just smaller in proportion to your whole life.
So when you're a baby and it's your first day on Earth,
oh man,
that's your whole life.
Oh, it's such a drag.
Well, it's hard living in the moment. Zan and I were talking about living in the moment, and it's hard to live in the moment, but I remember when we were walking across Spain in the Camino, for a whole month I had no obligations to do anything except walk. No phone bills, no petrol, no look after the house. All I had to do was get my shoes on and walk. And so everything was really here and now.
Mm.
And so I could really appreciate the fact that as we walked across Spain in spring, we could see the olive trees gradually blossoming over that month. It was a real here and now experience.
Well, that's what I think. That's thinking about it in the last couple of weeks in particular, that's why I think that kids are the only people who can truly live in the moment because there's no, as you say, responsibilities and therefore no desire to progress, earn more money, turn up for that appointment, all of that stuff, which is all looking
recharge
forward.
Recharge your phone because the battery's running a bit flat.
Yeah, and it's thinking about things that are going to affect you in the future instead of thinking about how to enjoy life now. It's a really interesting concept because people are always talking about the ultimate of living in the moment. But if you live in the moment, then you're ultimately acting childlike, and do you want that? I feel like we're going into philosophy territory.
I've got nothing wrong with living in the here and now.
It's a really interesting idea, though. So thanks for asking the question, and good on you for calling, Luke.
Thanks,
Thank you, Dr. Luke.
That's Jack White on Triple J. Love Interruption from his latest album, Blunderbuss. And you've been reading about Jack in the latest edition of Audio Technology magazine, Dr. Carl?
I have. I love to read stuff that I don't normally read and discover the whole world. And so I thought, oh, I haven't read a audio magazine for a while. And so there's all this technical stuff about, oh, these faders are really good and the Neve desk is good and
fun
these speakers
nerd stuff.
Are good. Good nerding stuff. And about how Valve amplifiers are better. Dale article about Dale Sherlock. And blow me down, there's Jack White.
Mm.
And I thought, wow, what's he doing here? And I had no idea. I was very ignorant. I didn't know he was a big analog guy.
Mm.
And his latest album, the Blunderbuss, is the first one to hit the charts at the top as recorded by an 8-track tape machine in,
really?
God, decades. And he goes on with some really good points. Like, he seems like a really smart guy, not just a great musician.
Mm.
But he says, yeah, I could go down the technology pathway, and yes, I would be able to tell you all about the difference between the Fraunhofer 620 flanger and a 621, but then I wouldn't do music. And so he knows to keep himself directed and not spin his wheels. And one of the reasons that he likes staying with the analog is that it forces you to make music in the moment. And there's none of this bit where, oh, look, don't worry about the drummer. Look, we can drop in those drumsticks. We just go on to Pro Tools. We just drop it in. We look at the waveforms, blah, blah, blah. He says, no, mate, it's about the feeling.
Yeah.
And I love the way that he's using the technology in a way that brings back the feeling.
Yeah.
And so my respect for him went up another notch because he wasn't just a great musician. He also knew how to bring different feels together. He seems like a really well-balanced guy.
And he's got his own studio in Nashville where he produces other people's music as well. So,
well, he had to do that because it was the only way he could do what he wanted. Like, he didn't want the compression thing. And he said, can't you just turn the volume up? They said, no, we've got to compress it. And finally there was a letter from one guy to another guy and said, why don't we just try turning the volume up? Okay. He doesn't mind using a bit of technology. Like, you know, if you've got a whole complicated thing, you can use an automated fader here and there. But basically, go back to the way God intended with magnetic tape. He was even arguing about the advantage of 7.5 inches per second over 15 inches per second.
Nerd.
Love it. Love it. But the thing is, he uses it to make great music with feeling.
He does, and he likes to turn it up to 11 as well. All right, let's get through some more callers who have been waiting on the line. 1-300-0444-536 before you get on out of here, Dr. Carl. Charlie's calling in from Seaforth. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, doctors. How are you?
Very well.
Good, Dr. Charlie.
What's your question?
I'm just wondering, every time I pluck a nose hair, I break out into like a real bad sneezing fit. And I'm just wondering if that's just me or if it happens to other people as well.
No, you are properly wired up. One of my favourite jobs when I worked as a doctor was going around doing the wiring up checks on the newborn babies. And so you get the little baby and you hold it in the palm of your hand. This baby smells really nice. It's about one day old. And you hold it on your elbow and you spin around and then you stop suddenly. You see the eyes go flick, flick, flick and think, okay, that's wired up properly. And it's wonderful stuff. You know, they smell nice. It's a happy, feel-good thing. You never find anything wrong. Anyway, and in your case, you are properly wired up. If I do an interruption, an irritant, some sort of trauma to your respiratory pathway, that is to say, yep, your schnoz, and pull a hair out or do anything else to the hair, blow me down, you respond properly by sneezing. You are responding as you should. Your sneeze is reacting to something big and toxic that might come and land on one of the hairs and saying, get it out of here, don't let it in. You are properly wired up. You can have a genuine cardboard certificate of proper wired upness.
So I'm a normal boy?
I wouldn't go that far. But with regard to your schnoz, you are normal.
Thanks for the call, Charlie.
Thank you, Dr. Charlie.
Yeah, normal schnoz. That's what you took away from today. Let's go to beautiful Port Ferry where Ryan is on the phone. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Ryan, are you there?
Ryan, talk to us.
Sorry.
Come on down.
Come to the phone, Ryan.
Come to the phone. Ignore everybody else. We're here for you, man.
What's your question, yep, Ryan?
Now, I've been a chef for about 8 years and I can pick up things that are about 60, 70 degrees, but I can't get used to hot steam.
The trouble with the 60 degrees, okay, to lift something by one centigrade degree from, say, 60 to 61 uses one unit of energy. And then to lift it from 99 to 100 degrees, to lift water from 99 to 100 degrees and it's still water, takes one unit of energy. But to turn it from water at 100 degrees into steam at 100 degrees takes 540 units of energy. The temperature is still the same, but you've had to rip molecules apart and make it take up a lot more volume. And so as it condenses, when the steam condenses on you, it'll give you 540 units of energy. In other words, the same as if the water had magically dropped from 540 degrees down to zero, it dumped that much energy on you. Steam is a killer.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Ryan.
And if you want to find out more, look up latent heat of vaporization in our good friend Wiki. Over to you, Dr. Zan.
All right. I think
she's shaking her head at me.
No, that's fine.
At least you didn't roll your eyes.
I think we've got time for one more quickie.
Yep.
It's one we've had before, but I think that a lot of people want to still know the answer. James is calling in from Batemans Bay.
Hi,
hey, James.
G'day, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
I just want to ask Dr. Carl, why does it seem to get colder just on daybreak in the morning than it is at night time itself? Do we just feel that way, or is it actually cooler as the sun comes up?
Don't know. Asked a bunch of meteorologists about it, got a bunch of opinions. Firstly, it does get cooler whenever the sun is not shining upon the land. We're radiating the heat into space, and if there's no cloud cover, it's just going straight into black space and it gets really quite cold.
Yep.
Secondly, the meteorologists agree that there's something going on, but they're not sure what. And thirdly, the best theory they gave me, and it's not peer-reviewed literature, let me emphasise this, is that the sun is over the horizon, on the other side of the horizon. And it heats up the air above you. That air then rises and brings in a breeze of colder air from inland.
Righty-o.
So even though the sun has just suddenly shone in your face, there's still a cold air from somewhere else. And the contrast between the cold air on your skin and the supposed warmth that the sun's supposed to deliver, I mean, you can see it, therefore it should be warm. Hey, it's not delivering. It sucks, man.
Until it starts to rise and start shining upon us directly.
Yes. But I don't know if that's true. That's only what I've been told in verbal conversations as opposed to peer-reviewed literature.
Hey, thanks for the call, James.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. James.
One more question for you, Dr. Carl. Mm-hmm. Last year there was a very, very wet summer in many parts of Australia. La Nina hit.
Yep.
This year are we heading towards El Nino? Will it be drought?
Ish. So the normal pattern is the El Niño, about 12 years, then neutral, and then La Niña. We had two La Niñas, one after another.
Mm.
So the La Niñas gave us the rain on the east coast, and two of them, one after the other, bang, bang. And the rain over in the central and west coast was due to changed cyclone activity. So overall, all of Australia had the extra rain. It does appear as though we are heading into another El Nino. And look that up, and the difference is the...
So the El Nino is dry.
Yeah, El Nino is dry. And the way they found this out was a bunch of Indian mathematicians found that whenever the air pressure went up in Darwin... it went down in Tahiti.
Oh, okay.
And that is the oscillation, ENSO.
And there is your weather forecast for the next 4 months. Bureau of Meteorology, top that. Hey, we'll see you next week, Dr. Carl.
Peachy keen.